Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening. This is Terry Dodd. Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. Sharon, are you on with us?
I am, Terry.
All right. It worked. That's in technology great when it works. It's horrible when you can't make it work, but when it works, it's wonderful.
Well,
Red Beckman,
right.
Are you on with us? Red, are you on with us? Well, Sharon, I'm going to open us with a prayer, and I'm sure Red will be on live here with us in just a moment. And then I'll introduce you and turn the floor over to you once we've got Red live.
Okay.
Heavenly Father, I just want to thank you for this great day and all the many ways that you have been blessing us. We're just so thankful tonight to have Sharon Rondeau with us, Father, and we pray that you'll help this show go smoothly and that we will be able to put the message out to the people in a way that it's understandable and clear and that it'll glorify you. We ask your spirit to be with us, and we're just thankful for your son. In his name we pray, amen. Red
amen.
Beckman, are you live?
Good evening all again. This is Dr. Kate. Everyone has dropped. We'll should be back on in just a second. Hang on there. Hi, Sharon. Red, this is Dr. Kate. Are you there?
Yes,
I'm
I am.
Here.
Very good. Very good. We're waiting for Terry to get back on, and I'm just going to mute myself, and I'm sure Terry would like you to go ahead and start. Perhaps with a prayer, I guess. He'll be on in just a second.
Terry has had the prayer already, Dr. Kate. By the way, I'm... saddened to hear about your loss here in the last week or so.
Thank you much. Thank you.
I'm sure you had a lot to be thankful for as well as sorrow for. So.
That's for
good
sure.
Good to have you back.
A gift to live to 96 years old and remain clear as a bell all the way through.
Oh, my.
Yes.
That's wonderful, Dr. Kate. I echo Mr. Beckman's sentiments, of course, and that is amazing that she was sharp as a tack. That's wonderful.
Really was. It was a blessing for her to go, and, you know, the sorrow was left for us behind. But I'll tell you, I am even more dedicated to what we're doing, because I'll be darned if I'm going to let the sacrifices of my mother and her parents go unmatched and let this country go to pot. So,
sure.
Let me see if this is Terry. Terry, is that you? Not yet. Okay.
Oh, we can't get along without Terry.
Why don't you all just start, and I'll get Terry on as soon as he's there.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Sharon, and good evening to you. And we had you on one night, but we just barely got acquainted. And now I understand that you have some questions about the 16th Amendment and the 17th, of course. I'm involved in that and have been for quite a while. So I will try to answer your questions as best I can as to what happened, how it happened, and what is happening yet today. So it's all yours to ask the questions.
Okay, thank you so much. I was really looking forward to this when Terry invited me to come on. It had started by the fact that someone had sent me a link to a New York Times article from 1895 stating that the U.S. Supreme Court had declared an income tax bill that had been passed by Congress unconstitutional. And I don't have it in front of me, but the act had a different name, and I'm sure you know what it is. And so I wrote a little article on it when I had a little bit of, I don't want to say downtime, but I just wanted to investigate it because I happened to come across the link. So the article I wrote couldn't possibly have done this topic justice, but it did pique my interest, and I got a tremendous amount of response from my readers at the Post and email. And it's a news website that we investigate government corruption. And so this was really just the tip of the iceberg, as they say. And Terry contacted me, many of the other readers contacted me and filled me in on lots of things that I had missed in that initial article. Then he invited me to come on and speak with you. So there's so much to know, and obviously I'm a novice. That is the first article I ever wrote. I had heard things before about the 16th Amendment never having been properly ratified. I'd never really investigated it. I had read D.V. Kidd's column, and that was maybe the extent of it, maybe a couple of other things. So I guess what I'd like to know, I know you've been in the so-called Patriot Movement for a very long time. When did you first begin investigating the 16th Amendment? Or I guess I should say, what made you believe that it needed to be investigated in the first place?
I think that that is a story that really needs to be told and recorded, I guess, because I had traveled the state of Montana a great deal. I had we had produced and run television specials across the state. And by 1980, I was traveling all over the country, doing all kinds of interviews, television and radio, and I've done hundreds of radio talk shows. Anyway, in the spring of 1980, we ran a one-hour TV special, and we ran it all across the state of Montana. And we went to Haver. Well, we would run the television special on a Monday night, and prime time, and then that would give us four or five nights afterwards where we could have meetings in the various towns and communities that had been reached by our program. And it was really a unique situation compared to today, because at that point in time, there were no cable, there were no satellite dishes, there were... If it was one of the larger cities in the state, why, they would probably have two stations, and you had to get it with an antenna or however. And so we had a market that was very limited, and it worked out so well for us. And we ran the television, and the next night we were in Havre, Montana. If I remember right, that's a town of several thousand people. It's a railroad town, and we met there. We advertised the meeting on the television when we had the program, and there were about 280 people that met in that meeting room that night when I was there. And I used something entirely different than I had ever done before. I talked about what our government and the politicians and the judges and attorneys were doing to our language, and how that they were tampering with the meaning of words to give them the opportunity to pass legislation that should never have been passed. I had been challenging audiences all over Montana and different places in the nation, and I would start out and I'd say, we know our public servants lied to us about Pearl Harbor and Korea and Vietnam and Social Security and energy shortage, Watergate, and the list went on and on and on. And I would challenge the audience, can you tell me one time that you were told the truth about any major happening in the United States or even in the world in the last 100 years? And I was never challenged. I never had anybody challenge what I was saying. Anyway, these tours across the state were very effective. We had great audiences and all that. But there was a young fellow in Havre, Montana, that came to the meeting, and he was just beside himself. He just... It just blew his mind to think that they had lied to us about so many things, and he was the last one to leave the meeting room. He took copies of every book and every pamphlet that we had, and he was a young businessman, a small business person, and also with farm connections, and he started to call me in my home. If I was home, why, he would call, and he had an 800 number for his business, and he would call, and it'd probably be 10 o'clock at night when he called, and we might be talking till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were discussing all of the problems that we have in this country. And this was 1980, and one night, June of 1980, Sam and I were having a lengthy conversation. And he said to me, he said, Red, you have challenged audiences all over this state and our nation. You've got that long list of lies. He said, you don't suppose that the Internal Revenue Service, that the 16th Amendment, which Congress had gotten, supposedly ratified and everything. He says, you don't suppose that the 16th Amendment was never ratified, that they attached that to our Constitution, our United States Constitution, as Amendment 16. It kind of took me aback for a second or two, and then I said, Sam, with the track record that our government, our politicians, our public servants, the track record that they have for truth, we can bet without very much problem at all that the 16th Amendment is a fraud, that it was never properly ratified. And Sam said, we are going to find out. And of course, I had to learn something, and that was that my friend Sam was an expert on the English language. He was tops. He was about mid-30s, and as I remember, and here this fellow is. He is an absolute genius on all of this material that we were dealing with, and it was an amazing thing, and because he went out and he got about a half a dozen, mostly farmers, ranchers, to agree with him that we needed to have an investigation, and we were the ones going to have to do it. And it never occurred to us that we should have had some politicians or such work on it. It never occurred to us at all. We didn't hesitate at all. And I myself, I want this understood very well. I myself, I didn't spend all that much time doing the nitty-gritty of contacting the archivists in each and every state. To get all of the documentations. I didn't do all of that. I was the cheering section. I was the guy that was kind of the glue, you might say, that put this thing on its way. And so that is what started. That is what started the people's research an investigation of something that the United States government had done, the politicians had done it to us, and it just never occurred to us that we could go to somebody else and tell them to do it. No, we went and did it ourselves. And it's an amazing thing, but we did it, and this is what's going on in our country today. People are taking on the challenge. And they're trying to unravel all of the bad information, the lies, and the corruption that's so prevalent in our country. And with that, I'll let you come up with another question.
Okay. Well, thank you for that wonderful historical background as to how you became interested. That's very interesting. That you just kind of said, you asked each other, I guess, what are the chances that the IRS is a sort of a creation of a lie? Now, how did you recruit Mr. Benson to go to the state legislatures? Because I understand he visited every state that was a state at the time that it was supposedly ratified, and that he obtained proof from the state legislatures that whether it's their archives or their, you know, their historical documents, that some of them did not ratify it. But where did you meet him? How did you kind of enlist him?
This really is a story that needs to be told. By the fall of 1980, I wrote my first book, The Fall of 1980, and it was the title of it was Born Again Republic. And we had one of the people that was researching this from Havre, Montana. He was a retired enlisted man from the Air Force, but he had some good years left because I think he was only about 50 when he retired. But one of the first things they found was that there was a Senate document, 240, that was out there, and it was in existence, had been in existence since the early 1930s. It was a research product of a Congress or a senator from Ohio. And so Sam contacted The congressional delegation from the state of Montana and said, find us a copy of Senate Document 240. And within a week, the answer came back that the document no longer existed. And, of course, we knew that it was an official document and Senate document, and therefore somebody had either violated the law or they were lying to us, one or the other. And this one gentleman, the retired Air Force fellow, went to Helena, Montana on some other business, I think, and he went to the state law library there at the Capitol in Helena, Montana, and he was snooping around, and he found his way into a storage room where they had a lot of books, and he found a copy of Senate Document 240. Sam got the book, and he analyzed it, and he dissected it. And he said the 16th Amendment in the early 30s, the U.S. Senate knew that the 16th Amendment had not been properly ratified. And I wrote about Senate Document 240 in my book, Born Again Republic, in 1980, the fall of 1980. By January of 1983, this ad hoc committee up there in Montana, and there was one gentleman from Wyoming, northern Wyoming, that really contributed to this effort. And he was having a major battle with the Internal Revenue Service. They had convicted him for tax evasion and all this kind of thing. But he was a dedicated American. He's an older man than I. He's still alive. But he did a fantastic job of coordinating and gathering up all the material that was being sent to the committee from different states in the union. And by January of 83, the committee had collected the documents, the record of how the state legislators had ruled and how they had voted on the 16th Amendment question, whether they wanted their state to be one of the states to ratify this. And they had all of the documentations, a documentation from all of the states that had anything available. I think it was Nebraska that had a fire, and some of their documents had burnt and one thing or another. However, there was far and away enough, you know, documentation right from the archives in the states. I was subpoenaed in a tax case in Fort Worth, Texas, in March of 1983. I took the file put together by my friends up there, and I took that with me, and I testified in that case. However, the judge would not let the jury hear my testimony. When I testified, they've got a beautiful old courthouse in Fort Worth, probably been there 150 years. The acoustics are perfect, and I had a big audience. Every seat was full, and there was standing room only, and they were all FBI, IRS, and ATF, and all the other alphabet soup outfits had their people there, and it was at least 95% men, not women. And come to find out, the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor, had lied to the judge and told the judge that I was so terribly dangerous and that The judge should order troops around the courthouse, ambulances, fire trucks, all of that around the federal courthouse in Fort Worth, because I was the national president of the Posse Comitatus. Well, this clown didn't know nothing about the Posse Comitatus, because it's supposed to be organized in the county, and each county is separate, they're autonomous, and the guy just didn't know what he was talking about, and the judge just brushed him aside. However, when I testified, I was called to the stand, and I sat in the witness chair while they had some court proceedings where they were chastising this prosecutor somewhat, because I had had a lengthy interview with the U.S. Marshals Service when I got to Fort Worth, and I had developed a real strong rapport with the U.S. Marshal, the head honcho for the Marshals in Fort Worth. He was an older fellow, and he understood exactly where I was coming from, and we just had a good conversation. Anyway, the prosecutor had to apologize for lying to the court, but anyway, it was kind of an interesting little sidelight, and after all of that procedure had gone through, why, then they swore me in, and I was able to testify. And that was a very fascinating thing. It was with that crowd. You don't want to put a crowd in front of me, because I'm gonna be wound up, and I'm gonna let loose with all the power that I can muster. Anyway, we got into the. Well, what I did, I need to bring this out. I ended up questioning the prosecutor. And I asked him if I understood the Constitution and that he swore an oath to uphold and defend it. And he did, and he knew, and I said, now, when you went to law school, they told you that the 16th Amendment was ratified. Did you check the record out? Did you check to see if it was actually ratified, or was it a nasty joke pulled on the American people? And he said, well, I believed him. Well, I said, did you realize that you were believing a lie? Well, no, he didn't think that it was a lie. And it was just such an interesting conversation, because this young fellow, he was probably 35 years of age, he didn't know enough to, I doubt if he knew enough to come in out of the rain, because he was just, I was able to question him. I was the witness. And I had a chance to question him, and the judge was sitting there smiling. I kept watching him out the corner of my eye, and he let me get away with this. I told him, I said, there's a lot of a big difference between believing and knowing. And I reached in my briefcase and pulled part of that file put together by the Montana historians. I set that on the railing in front of me. I said, now you believe that the 16th Amendment was ratified. And I had my hand on that pile of documents. I said, I'm here to tell you that the 16th Amendment is a fraud, because it was fraudulently declared ratified. And I've got the documentation to prove it. Well, the judge had decided that I couldn't, they didn't need to hear my testimony. It went into the record, of course, but That was the first that the U.S. Justice Department understood, really had a, an understanding of what we had done, what we had tried, were trying to do, and so there was considerable consternation on the part of the feds, and they started building, you know, the wall of, you know, the between truth and that which is false. And so the next time, and of course the question was, how did Bill Benson get involved? The next June in '83, I was asked to testify in a case that's my 82-year-old head isn't working right. A suburb of Chicago, in the Indiana, on the Indiana side of the state. The state line that runs up through there. And they had a federal courthouse, and, of course, that was a massive population there. This was Alan Lee Buck to trial, a young fellow that, you know, they made a criminal out of him. And but I was able to testify, and... then the judge ruled that he did not have to accept our documentation on the ratification of the 16th Amendment because it just never dawned on us that that we should have had all of these documents certified. Well, the proper way for Judge Moody, in that he was a Reagan appointee, the proper procedure for that judge would have been to recess the court and give the Justice Department 10 days or a week or whatever. 10 days would be sufficient because they had the record. We've got the record, and they can go through there and see exactly what each state legislature had done back in prior to 1913, before they declared it ratified, starting in 1909. And within 10 days, the Justice Department would have had no problem whatever going to the archives in each state and ask for duplication of the documents which we had. And, you see, that would have been the proper way. But no, the judge says no, and Alan Lee Buckta went to jail because the truth was not allowed to, you might say, perform in that courtroom. Bill Benson was there as a paralegal working with Andy Spiegel, who was the defense counsel, lawyer. After the disappointment and all, Andy Spiegel, Bill Benson, and myself, we went to a supper club and we had a very lengthy dinner. And, of course, it was evening, late in the evening. And I don't know how long we were there, but it was considerable. I think the waiters were getting rather tired of watching us and looking out at it, over us. Anyway, Bill Benson, Andy Spiegel decided that we had to have these documents that we had, get them certified. And the court more or less gave the directions that these documents needed to be done properly. We were to maintain custody of the documents at all times and all this kind of stuff. And so Bill Benson agreed to go. And he went he started in 1984. And he went to the East Coast pretty much in the Midwest in the early part of this. I think that, I think he would admit this, that he had some real questions about how authentic our documents were and all of that. Well, he didn't have to go to very many states, and he found that the Montana historians had the documents that needed to be used to prove that the 16th Amendment was a fraud. He spent, as I remember, and I may be wrong on this, but I think he spent about 3 weeks in Washington, D.C., going into the National Archives, and they charged us a tremendous price, of course, for the certification on the documents they had, and they had a lot of them. They had, from all the states and all kinds of things pertaining to the 16th Amendment. And, of course, the 17th. The Montana historians were well enough informed so that they knew that the 17th Amendment was a very dangerous thing and that it was something that had caused a lot of problems, for our country. Changing the Constitution there with the 17th was not a good idea, and it has caused a lot of problems for us in this country. So the Montana historians had collected the documentation on the 17th as well as the 16th. We felt that the 16th Amendment was the easiest to prosecute and the easiest one to get across because it had an effect on everybody's hind pocket. And so we had kind of set the 17th Amendment aside until we could get a ruling on the 16th. Anyway, you know the story. We've still got the 16th, and we've still got the 17th. And Bill went to all the states. It cost us quite a bit of money to do that by our standards then. But I felt that we had no choice but to do what we did. And I've never been sorry that we did it the way we did. Bill Benson, we could not have had a better man to do what he did. When he walked into an office for the archives and such, he had his three-piece suit on. He had his tie. He had his cufflinks. And he was an imposing person, and he didn't take no for an answer from nobody. And that's what we had to have. He had to have a hard nose. And Bill was a born investigator. He had done enough of it over the years to where he knew what he was doing, and he did the job very well. Now, he had all of the East, the states that are closer together and easier to get to and such. And we had about, I think it was 13 more states to do in the West. And we were running out of time in 1984. We wanted it done. And so I was able to charter a small twin-engine airplane and a pilot. And Bill flew to Denver and went to the state capitol, got the documents, the certified documents at the state capitol. I don't remember, but it seems to me he took a bus from Denver to Cheyenne, and that's where he met the plane. And we were able to get those last 13 states in much, much less time. If people have any idea of geography at all, they'll know that from Cheyenne to Pierce, South Dakota is... it's quite a job to find some connections to get there. Then from there to Bismarck, North Dakota, a long ride and not too many good connections. But with the plane, it was very simple and very quick. And from there, it was Montana and Idaho and Nevada and New Mexico, Arizona, California, and on up the coast. And on Christmas Eve of 1984, Bill Benson called me from Olympia, Washington. He said, "I've got the last one." And I'll tell you, that was an emotional moment, and it's still emotional for me, because this had been a project that took a full year to do it right and get enough funds to, you know, do this. Bill, he went, you know, and did a good job. He didn't stay in the flop houses and such. He stayed in decent quarters and that type of thing. And so it was January of 1985, we started putting together the book, The Law That Never Was. I went to Chicago, the missus and I, and we spent, the better part of about 4 or 5 months in Chicago getting all of this done. And we had to buy a computer. We had to find somebody that knew how to run it, and that didn't always work out the best. But that's how Bill Benson got involved and what he did. You know, I don't think he was really a constitutionalist to start with. But the more he got exposed to the people out here that are putting their lives and their fortunes on the line to battle this evil thing called the Internal Revenue Service. And that answers your question there, I hope.
Yes, thank you. It answers it very, very well. Thank you again for all that background. Now, do you think most people are of a mindset that they can absorb what you've just said, maybe not all that you've just said, but can they absorb the fact that if true, and you've presented some very compelling evidence, and I haven't read your books, but I'd love to and intend to, do you think most people would believe you, or do they believe you when you speak to them?
Most of them, it goes in one ear and out the other, bounces off the walls or something in their mind, and it's real difficult for them to just believe that everything that the government has done in the last 100 years or so has been fraudulent. It's been evil. It's been, I'll address that here a little later, perhaps, why that is. What's going on here? Excuse me. It was not. Even myself, you see, I still thought that our government was the best system out there, and it was real difficult for me because I was an Army veteran, and I've saluted that flag, and I am proud of that flag. You know, you've got to make some mental adjustments when you get going on something like this, and then you find out that the politicians are a bunch of con artists, and that they have taken advantage of our trust. They have violated our trust, and of course that makes me angry. I was 6'4" and redheaded, and I'll never forget when we went through Freedom of Information and made them give me a copy of all the records. One of the IRS agents had written a note in longhand, and he said, I don't remember exactly how he dressed me, but he said, in the effect that Mr. Beckman is 6'4", redheaded, and has a tendency to impress people or something to that effect. And it was kind of interesting, and of course we're going to protect that and give that to the grandkids as we go along. But they knew that I was not going to be shoved aside. I was not going to let that happen, and I was not alone. My friend Sam is a researcher. He prefers to be left alone so he can continue his research. And at some point out here in the future, I have a hunch that he'll be organizing his research, and it'll be a fantastic work that he has done. And all this, he's farming quite a large acreage because he inherited his father's place where he grew up, apparently. I've got some answers for my own personal use to what's going on. Let me say it this. About 25 years or so ago, I went to the Yellowstone County courthouse there in Billings, Montana. And I had use of the law library. They were very good about letting me use that library because I had a lot of friends and admirers in the courthouse. And I went up there and I looked up the case where the U.S. Supreme Court took the Bible out of the classroom, the public school classroom. I read the entire case. There's a lot of verbiage there. But when I digested it, what I read was that the court said, "Thou shalt not have any other God before the federal God." That's what I read. All the verbiage and everything was nothing more than legalese, lawyer garbage. And it could have been said in less than 25 words. And they've used that case as a basis for some of the other cases that have come along. Thou shalt have no other God before the federal God. And that's why you can put the picture of a pervert on the wall in the classroom, but you can't put the Ten Commandments there. Now that's getting pretty ridiculous. And so, anyway, hopefully I've answered some more questions, and there's more coming.
Yes, you have. This is really quite fascinating. Do you have, or does anyone have, any idea of how many trillions or quadrillions of dollars have been confiscated from Americans since the declaration that the 16th Amendment was passed? Has anyone computed that?
Yes, I think that it has, and I think the figures are available. But these are figures that are so large that there's very few that can wrap their minds around the kind of numbers that they've got. We know we've been had. We've been really you know, I see they violated our trust, and, you know, I trusted them. I was just a young fellow going into the service, and, boy, we were so patriotic and all of that. But when we find out that this government is so corrupt, I've had some very interesting things happen when I traveled the country. I was in Portland, Oregon, back about 1981 or 2. I didn't log it. I should have put it down. But a fellow came and introduced himself, and he was one of the three people in our Navy, our intelligence, in Pearl Harbor, and they had cracked the Japanese code. Mm-hmm. And there was three of them. And they knew about the Japanese fleet coming, and they tried to warn the Secretary of War and all three of them were locked up until after the raid so that they could not, you know, tell what was happening, what was coming. You see, if our Navy had had, you know, just a little bit of warning, all those battleships and such would have been out at sea, and they'd have probably wiped out the Japanese fleet at that point. The World War II would have been very short. This gentleman, he came to a meeting where I was speaking, and before the meeting, why he wanted to talk to me, and we went off by ourselves, and he explained to me what happened. He is now passed away, of course, and I'll tell you, I don't know how many experiences such as that. History. Getting to understand and realize that there was some history that we have not been able to access. I probably got sidetracked there a little bit.
Red.
Yes.
Red. May I try to address the question that that Sharon threw out? I'm not sure that the question is even answerable, Sharon, and let me just give you a little bit of why I say that. First of all of the taxes that we pay as far as income taxes go not to support our government or to pay for our military or any of those things. All of the money that we pay in income taxes goes to pay the interest on the fraudulent debt to the international banksters that control the International Monetary Fund, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, which is something people aren't really aware of. That's really the group that runs our treasury, that really controls the IRS, et cetera, Federal Reserve, et cetera. It's called the ESF. And if you're not familiar with that, you need to do some research on the ESF. The Exchange Stabilization Fund. But my point is that all of the money that we pay goes to pay interest. It doesn't pay for the cost of operating our government. They started out with less than 10% of our GDP in debt, and now our debt is a much higher percentage, almost 50% of our gross domestic product. And so the interest on that, and the reason they escalate that debt is because they want to increase the amount of interest owed, because that's how they primarily rip us off. But it's not the only way we rip us off. Now, let me sidetrack for just a second. When we start talking about dollars, we're really not talking about dollars. We're talking about pieces of paper that we call dollars because we've been brain soiled, as Red would say, into believing that those pieces of paper are dollars. They're not. They're really just out of thin air. They really have no value. So when you start talking about these trillions of dollars, you can't really look at it like it's dollars because, and you can't add up dollars from 1915, for example, to dollars today because they don't equate. They're not the same thing. They don't have an intrinsic value like gold or silver or other precious commodities. So the whole thought pattern is distorted. And then you look at the fractional reserve banking system, which is the other way that they have successfully stolen our production by taking and being able to monetize debt. They have stolen so much money or what we call money in that way that the number, you know, is almost incalculable. You can't calculate it. Then you look at the bubbles. You look at the way they've repackaged it, the way that they have fraudulently hypothecated things. The dollars, if you were to try to I don't think it's too mind-boggling to even try to go there because the way that they have stolen our production has become so sinister and so complex, and they have continued to escalate it over time to the point where they're stealing it all. And the only way to really tell, I think the only way to really tell how much they've stolen is the fact that these international banksters now are said to control over 90% of all the infrastructure and assets of the world. So they've in essence stolen 90% of all of our cumulative production in the last 100 years. That's the kind of number we're dealing with. But what do these trillions mean? They don't mean anything because they don't have any intrinsic value behind them. Did that answer your question?
Yes, yes, that's excellent. And I believe your email to me the other day had definitely touched on that. So that clarifies things quite a bit. Thank you. Which leads us to what you just mentioned regarding the currency. If we have fiat currency and that's all we can really deal with, or maybe it isn't, what could be done? What could be done to remedy that situation such that people are using real money? And if their eyes are open to the fact that the income tax, first of all, the amendment was never passed and that it's unconstitutional anyway, what can people do about those two things? Because the way I see it is multiplied by 310 million people, we could get a completely different control over our personal and our country's finances if we were dealing with real money and not paying an unconstitutional income tax to an illegitimate government, so to speak.
Red, do you want to go first? Do you want me to go first?
I think we need to go. The Tea Party people are talking about the Constitution a great deal, and they want to get rid of the income tax, of course. But what I have found is that, and I've written this up in a couple of my books, I think we need to go to Section 8 of the first article of our Constitution. And there's some serious problems right in the very beginning. Here's what the Section 8, this is the way it starts out. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, comma. Now, it says the Congress shall have power to lay and what? And collect. It does not say that Congress is to create an agency like the IRS. The founders of this country were very intelligent men. The Congress, they are the ones who spend the money, not the president or the courts. It's the Congress that spends the money. So the founders, they said, Congress shall have the power to lay and collect. The tax collection mechanism should be in your local congressman's office, where you, if you have an argument about the taxes and such, you can bring in your congressman and say, hey, wait a minute, buddy, what is this supposed to do? What are we supposed to do here? We've got to have some answers here. Now, how many of you have heard this argument? The Congress has the power to collect taxes, not the IRS, not an agency. The Congress were, you know, they didn't want to collect taxes because that would probably interfere with their re-election at the next election. And right in the very first sentence, or partial sentence, they have violated the law. And here's, I'm going to read that again. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, comma, duties, comma, imports, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense of the general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. There is nothing there that says that they can put a income tax on us, nothing there that says they can put a property tax on us. They don't have that power. They have to make, they have to get the duties, imposts, and excises. They've got to put them in place, and that's where they've got to go to get their money to spend. And so, you see, talking about the Constitution without really dissecting it and understanding what it's saying, we've just got to understand, you know, what the founders were trying to tell us, and they were trying to save us a lot of grief, but we didn't listen. And so that's just a byline there, a little sidetrack, a rabbit trail to follow. And, of course, you go to Article 9 and Section 4, and there it says, and I better read that. I better... let me see if I can spot that right quick. They wanted us to understand something. And Section 9 of the first article of the Constitution says no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. They tried to reinforce what they were saying in Article 1, Section 8. And, you know, when we're dealing with Tea Parties and people and such, we need to go to Article 1, Section 8 and Article 9, Section 4 to give them the constitutional foundation, you see, to what they're trying to learn and what they're trying to do for our country.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Do you think that most or all congressmen today serving in the Congress are aware that the 16th Amendment was not ratified properly?
I think that most of them have been, they've had it brought to their attention. Now, I make a statement, and I stand behind that statement, and that is this. Every federal judge in the United States of America today belongs in a prison cell. They are all felons.
Mm-hmm.
They're felons. And the evidence is prima facie. The evidence is there in their own documents. The decisions that they have made, the rulings they have made, and such, let me see if I can find 18 USC Section 4. I thought I had it marked here, but I guess I didn't. I'll have it here in a bit. But anyway, the law is clear. If you know of a crime, you have to bring it to the attention of the proper authorities. Now, that's the law of the land. And if you don't, if you know of a crime and you don't bring it to the attention of the proper authorities, then you are a party to the violation of the law. And so there is no way that these federal judges across this country don't know about this 16th Amendment fraud. There's just absolutely the judges. They have these, I think it's three times a year, that they meet all of the judges from an appellate, a Ninth Circuit or whatever. We're in the Ninth Circuit here in California where I'm at. And they have a meeting, I think it's three times a year, in Reno, Nevada. And they discuss all the things that are coming up before them, and they decide how they're going to answer them. Now, I mentioned USC Section 4, which reads this way: whoever, having knowledge of the actual commission of a felony recognizable by a court of the United States, conceals and does not as soon as possible make known the same to some judge or other person in civil or military authority under the United States shall be fined not more than $500 or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. That's pretty clear. That's pretty easy to understand. And that's just one. That is just one section of the U.S. Criminal Code, Title 18, that pertains to the crimes that we have been exposed to with this 16th Amendment fraud. Every federal judge in this country is a felon. Every single one, don't forget it. Every single U.S. attorney in this country, Michelle Bachmann is a candidate running for the presidency of the United States. She's a third-term congressman from Minnesota. And prior to being a politician, she was an assistant U.S. attorney prosecuting tax cases because her expertise as a lawyer is tax matters. Michelle Bachmann knows all about our 16th Amendment fraud thing, and she is a felon because she has not done anything about it, nothing, absolutely nothing. She is continuing because they think they have the power to hide their lies and hide their law violations of law behind their legal verbiage. So I... that's a statement I make, and I can back it up.
Well, that's very strong and very telling about what's happened in the country since this 16th Amendment was placed upon us. It's really quite a revelation. My head is spinning, frankly, from everything that you're saying. What do you think citizens today can do? I mean, this 16th Amendment was declared ratified a long time ago. We're talking almost 100 years.
February 3rd, 1913.
Yes, Yes, so we're close to 100 years, I guess 98, 97 and a half, whatever. What
yeah.
can citizens
yeah.
do? How do we educate one another? And, of course, there are so many things that people focus on. People are focused on Obama's ineligibility and the treachery of the Congress in keeping him there. They have the power to remove him, and they don't. The media and then all of the other crimes going on that have been ongoing, as you mentioned, the judiciary and many, many things happening, even at the state and local level, innocent people being railroaded into prison, which is something I've reported on quite a bit in a local area in Tennessee, corrupt judges, clerks, you name it. With all of this going on, all this turmoil and the economic situation in which we find ourselves, based on some of this treachery, what can the average citizen do? How do they even begin overturning this, educating their neighbors, educating themselves, and then taking action to try to roll back or correct what has gone wrong with our Republican form of government that we were given by the founders?
I have been involved in trying to educate my fellow Americans now for over 35 years. And there's been a lot of frustration simply because people are products of a government propaganda machine known as public education. And that's public education monster has been the reason why the American people do not accept anything like what we're talking about unless they get recruited like I was. The IRS, they've recruited most of us out here in the tax protest. The people that really speak out, most of us were recruited into the tax protests by the Internal Revenue Service. And, of course, you have to realize that the IRS need tax protesters. They need tax protesters out here so that they can prosecute some of them on a regular basis and send them off to jail. And you see the story gets on the front page of the newspaper, and it becomes a major news item, and it just scares the hell out of people, I guess. It scares the money out of them because they don't want to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's an education process. I'm the inspiration behind the Fully Informed Jury Association out of Helena, Montana. I've been involved with them since they were instituted or started out. Anyway, they've done quite a job of trying to educate people as to how they can be a real force for what is right and what's wrong in this country with jury power. Grand jury power. We need grand juries that will take up the 16th Amendment question. And I can assure you that a grand jury has more power than all of the Congress. And this is something that people just do not understand because they were never taught this. And so we've got a major problem educating our fellow Americans. We have to continue. I'm reminded of the prophet in the Bible, Isaiah. And the children of Israel had their own nation. They had had a tax revolt, and they split off from the tribe of Judah. And had their own country, and they called themselves Israel. And there was 10 tribes there. And they had become quite, our God was not happy with them. They were not living the kind of life that their God would have them do. And so God had had many prophets come and warn the people of how they needed to clean up their act and serve the true God, but they would wander off and serve false gods and all this kind of stuff. And then God decided that it was time for a judgment. And he sent Isaiah, and what a spokesperson he was. He went out and he addressed the political and religious leaders of his day with the truth. And right in the beginning, when God commissioned him to do that, God had more or less told him that they were not going to listen, that the people of Israel were not going to listen to what he was trying to tell them. And Isaiah, he more or less thought that was rather strange that God would have him do that. But he got a handle on it and understood what Isaiah was, what he was supposed to do, and he did it. He performed so well. And the people of Israel refused to listen, and of course the Medes and Persians came in and conquered them, and there was a great migration of prisoners and slaves that were taken back with the conquerors to become servants and such. And it was about roughly 80 years later, I think, that Judah, they didn't listen. They didn't learn anything from what had happened to the 10 tribes. And so old Nebuchadnezzar came down and conquered them and took them to Babylon. And this is what happens when people don't listen, when they don't, when they don't recognize that they're involved in a spiritual world, a world where the Spirit of God is, and he likes to work and he likes to speak to people. And so this, I've had to come to this conclusion simply because I'm running out of time, of course, to at 82, I'm almost 83, it's just, you know, that I'm not going to have that much more time to give these interviews and that type of thing. And I really don't see the kind of spiritual renewal that we so desperately need in this country. When people can lie and get away with it and the people don't question it, there's something seriously wrong with their spiritual condition.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much for that. Why do you think that throughout history, nations have been known to self-destruct? We've read about the Romans and the Greeks, for that matter, how when the people voted themselves largesse from the treasury, everything became unmanageable, untenable, to the point where the welfare state could not be supported any longer. Many people feel we've reached that point in this country and there just isn't any more money. Why is it that nations have done this, and why does it appear to some, at least, that the United States has fallen into that same category?
The first thing we've got to do and really get this down into our thinking. You see, the public schools, the media and everything, they've got people believing that the United States government is the United States. all through history, governments have come and gone. Germany, in the 20th century, they had a couple of really bad situations where Germany was damaged severely. But those governments that were a party to that are gone, but Germany is still there. Am I right?
Yes, you are.
I remember doing an interview with an interviewer in Los Angeles. It was a nationwide hookup, and it was late night television. He had the late night. He was the largest late night talk radio in the country. This is about 81 or 82 when I did this, and of course it was late night, but anyway, we had a big audience all across the country, and I was explaining something, and I said, you have to remember that Germany was the first nation to be conquered by the Nazis in World War II. And the talk show host, and I shouldn't ever forget his name, and I'll probably think of it before this is over, but he just leaned back in his chair, and I knew I had to carry the program. I was on his program several times back in the 80s, and I had to carry the program because he was sitting there staring at me, and finally he came back up to his mic and he said, Red, he said, I have never heard that. A top-rated radio talk, national radio hookup, and he had never thought of that, and I dare say that there's a lot of people out there tonight listening to this that have never thought of this either, that Germany was the first nation to be conquered by the Nazis. And Germany is still there, aren't they? And they have become very strong and very wealthy over there because they're an industrious, a very hard-working people. And in this country, we've got to recognize that we, the people of the United States of America, have been conquered by a very, very evil political system. And we may have to go through some pretty painful scenarios to make this correction. Back there 25 years ago, excuse me, when I left the county courthouse and after I had read the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court on taking the Bible out of the classroom, I knew, and I made the statement after that, that the federal government was going to go down. The federal government was not going to survive the kind of, this kind of, this kind of sin. Let's quit calling it corruption. Let's take a little short three-letter word to identify it. This is where we're at. The federal government is going to self-destruct. Terry and I, we had Steve Pidgeon, the attorney from up in the Seattle area, on the program a couple of times, and it's been over a year ago, and he was on, and he made the statement, and this was an attorney. He said the federal government is self-destructing. It's going to go. And I'm convinced that that's what's going to happen. Now, what happened in the USSR back in December of 1991, The USSR was dissolved overnight because they were an anti-God system. When the Bolsheviks took over in 1917, one of the first things they did was they made a proclamation, there is no creator God. And they enslaved, they murdered about 60 million perhaps or more of the Russian people that believed there was a God and that he was involved in the affairs of men. And they were hauled off to the gulag and they were murdered. When the Soviet Union, the USSR, when that government went down that night, I knew it was coming. I knew it was going to happen because everything was going wrong in Russia for the USSR, and they were not going to survive their mistakes. The same goes for the United States of America, the government of the United States of America. I have to correct myself there. They cannot do anything right. They've got to cover every lie that they've put out with more lies. And they're just not going to survive their mistakes. Whether we can go through this without total anarchy and such, I don't know. I don't know how we will react. But in Russia, they didn't have much turmoil. They didn't have much chaos. The people went to work, and they've made some pretty fantastic changes over there with another political system. And I won't get into that any further. I hope it's not getting too far afield, Sharon, for what you're trying to do.
It leads me to another question. And to me, it makes me feel as though there's actually hope that could arise from all of this. And I guess what I'd like to ask you is, is that what you see, that nations do self-destruct, and even though our nation is relatively young and we see all of this, as you say, sin, corruption, whatever, a violation of the Christian principles on which the country was founded, is this part of a cycle, do you think, which actually results in people perhaps going back to the very basics? People today in this country, I think many of them are impoverished. People have lost their homes, their businesses, their livelihoods, many, many things. Hopefully they have not lost each other or faith in God. But could this be all part of a greater plan, do you think, and part of a cycle, a natural cycle, that actually will correct everything that has gone wrong in the last 235 years, such that we can make things right and start over?
Red, before you answer, I just want to let the callers. Red?
Go ahead,
Red, Gary. I want you to answer the question, but I just want the callers to know we've got somebody with a hand up, and I just want to let the callers know that we will be taking questions in just a couple of minutes. Please just hang on. Red, go ahead.
There's some theological error that is as prevalent in our society today as political error, and what I'm saying here now is all I can say is this is what I think. And don't blame somebody else, because what I'm saying is what I have come to understand. And I may be wrong. I'm not dogmatic about it. I think that I'm correct. When we look at history, history is made up of It's an account, a running account of failure. Over and over and over again, as strong as the Roman Empire was, it went down, it self-destructed. And the USSR went down, the government self-destructed. I think that we have to go back into the time period prior to what we read in Genesis, the first chapter and the first verse. It goes back. And the reason I say this is because when our Messiah King came, and before he really started his ministry, he went into the wilderness and he was tempted by Lucifer. And we have to take a good look at that encounter between our Messiah King and the fraudulent, the one who wants to be our Messiah King. And Lucifer took Christ up on a high mountain and showed him the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms of the earth. Don't forget that. He showed Christ the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms. Those three things go together. Don't forget it. Now, Christ turned them down. Christ did not reprimand Satan and say, you don't have the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms. Those aren't yours. Those don't belong to you. No, Christ did not dispute the fact that Lucifer had the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms under his control in this country. And in this, on this planet is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the entire planet. Now, I say, and I may be wrong, but I say that the Bible tells us about a redemption plan. We think about the redemption of our own personal soul, and that's important. But how about the redemption of planet Earth? Planet Earth is battling. It's under siege. It is being devastated in so many ways, and it's being damaged. And we have political animals out there that would love to drop an atomic bomb on Washington, D.C., or London, or Berlin, or wherever. You see, these are people who have accepted the satanic offer. They want the power, they want the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms of the earth. And Lucifer, of course, we have to understand his character. Our God is a creator. He is a master creator. Lucifer is a destroyer. He's a master destroyer. The Bible tells us that very clearly. And so when we have a nation that comes under the influence of greedy people, when it comes under the power of, and such of politicians and criminals that want the wealth, the power, and the kingdom, and they run the kingdom, and that's where we are. We have that kind of a situation right now in this country. We the people are becoming poorer by the day. And we see the news items talking about how that there's less than 10% of the population on the planet that control most of the wealth. And, you know, this is not a healthy situation. And so our Heavenly Father is going to make a correction. And I don't know how it's going to come. I don't have any clue as to how he has, what kind of plans he has. But there will be You know, when the U.S. Supreme Court back there in 1963 said, basically, thou shalt have no other gods before me, that's a violation of the First Commandment. A clear violation. God says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And in the Second Commandment, he says, for I am a jealous God. He is a jealous God, and he is not going to let Lucifer, you know, have his redemption plan. He wants to redeem, you know, that which God has planned. And I've had a certain amount entertainment, I guess. I've asked a lot of people, outspoken Christian people, say, why did our Heavenly Father, why did he come down to planet Earth and say, let there be light? And there was light. And he went on through 7 days of creation. And those first 5 days, he said, let there be, let there be, let there be. He had that kind of authority and that kind of power. On the sixth day, why didn't he just say, let there be Adam? Now, that's a theological question that I have never run onto a theologian that could give me a satisfactory answer to that. God took the dust of the earth and formed Adam, and Adam became a living soul, and he was he was connected to this planet. Now, let's go to John 3:16, the most quoted, the most memorized verse, I think, in the Bible. And it says, for God so loved mankind? It doesn't say that. For God so loved the world, he gave his son to redeem his planet. This planet was God's creation. He created Lucifer to be the administrator, and he put some conditions there, just like he did with Adam and Eve in the garden. He said, if you ever rebel, I'll have to put a curse on the planet. The curse was very simple. All God did as a judgment on Lucifer back there was turn out the lights. Turn out the light. And this became a frozen blob hurtling through space that was dark. But then God had a problem. Where is Lucifer today? Where has he been for all of these centuries? He's not been during the time when the earth was without form and void. He wasn't out there jumping from ice chunk to ice chunk and enjoying himself and his kingdom, his domain. No. He was at the throne of God, and you don't find him thrown out of heaven until the 12th chapter of the book of Revelations. And that's coming up very shortly, I'm afraid. I shouldn't say afraid. I hope that it happens shortly, where Lucifer is cast out of heaven. He's an evil spirit. He has the mobility of a spirit. And so he has spent his time in heaven condemning, accusing the God of heaven with being unrighteous and unfair and all of that. So God set up a plan to redeem planet Earth. And you and I are part of planet Earth. We're integral to the planet. We are part of the planet that God's only begotten Son died for, and we're going to see some big things happen at least you younger folks are going to see some big things happen in the near future, because I think it's God's time to make these things happen. I've meandered off here. I'm sorry. I've meandered off, but this is pretty close to my heart, this stuff, and you can probably detect that.
Absolutely. Terry, I didn't know if you wanted to say something.
I wanted to get the question in from area code 512, if they're still there. They had their hand up and wanted to ask a question. Area code 512, are you still there? You have a live mic, 512.
Oh, yes. This is Vaughn in Austin, Texas. I'd like to follow up on one of Sharon's questions. Can you explain the involvement of President Bush Sr. and Leo Wanta in the disappearance of $27 trillion from the federal funds?
I'm very, very much aware of that. And I'm very, very much aware of the fact that we're not going to see anything done properly in that system. It's going to be more lies, more stupidity on the part of a lot of people. I wouldn't worry and I wouldn't be that concerned with that at this point in time, because you're talking about dollars that you see, when this all happened, the dollar was worth a lot more than it is today. And so I wouldn't get carried away with that. I would monitor what's happening and what's being done, because it's an intriguing story, but I don't think that we, the people, are going to have much of an effect on that, you know, because you're not going to find much of an audience out there that want to listen to that story, you know. For the most part, you've got to recognize that the people that come through the public schools think they're educated. They think they've got the best education anybody has got on the planet of Earth, and they, a lot of them are just so bound by the lies and the false information that they have absorbed and called it truth, and they're not going to be much help to us, I can assure you. Hope I have answered your question.
Vaughn, let me jump in there for a second, if you will. Are you familiar with Midnight Think Tank or the White Hat reports or the White Hat call? Are you familiar with any of that? Well, I think Vaughn may have either hung up or maybe still listening. Let me just quickly address this, because I don't want to spend the rest of the time. I could easily spend a half an hour talking about this. Leo Wanta was an ambassador for Ronald Reagan, and he did not take these monies from the U.S. Treasury. There were some money used from the U.S. Treasury, but he actually it's been reported by the VK Durham Trust that some of the monies that were used in the play to try to bring down the Russian economy, to bring down the Russian ruble back during the Reagan administration, some of that money was actually fraudulently hypothecated from the instruments that were owed to the VK Durham Trust. And Leo Wanta parlayed that money that he was given control of, and he grew it by investing it around the world up to a $27.5 trillion number. In fact, that number today is believed to be much larger than that, and somewhere in the $60 to $70 trillion range. They've tried to bring some of those monies back into the country. It's been reported that those funds have been frozen, partially because of the international banksters and H.W. Bush and those people. The Clintons and the Bushes have all been trying to get their hands on that money. And $4.5 trillion was brought back into the country as a fee to Leo Wanta for being the trustee and raising that money through international investments in the first place. And they've locked that $4.5 trillion up. A trillion and a half of it would have been in taxes paid to the U.S. government, but they've frozen it. And they've tried to keep it quiet because they're trying to steal it, just like they're stealing everything else. So that's all I'll say about it. And Sharon, you got about 14 minutes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You know, I had heard, and I don't want to digress too much off the topic of the 16th Amendment, so I'll get back to that. But it's interesting you mentioned Leo Wanta, because I had heard a little bit about this story months ago, but I was never able to find anything that verified it. And I don't know if you've actually verified it yourself. But I did do some digging and didn't come up with too much, and maybe because it's so well hidden. So thank you for mentioning that. But in regard to the 16th Amendment, I know, Mr. Beckman, you had mentioned that there's a relationship to the 17th Amendment, perhaps because that one wasn't ratified properly either. Or what is the connection between those two amendments to the Bill of Rights?
Well, the connection isn't it isn't direct connected. The 17th Amendment, prior to the 17th Amendment, the state legislators, they selected who was going to be their U.S. senators in Washington, D.C. They were not voted on by the public.
Mm-hmm.
The state legislature would decide who they were going to send to Washington, D.C. as a senator. And by doing it this way, the founders had method in their wisdom. And supposedly the state legislature would have a ring in the nose, you might say, of every one of those senators, so that if they didn't perform properly in the best interests of the state legislature could jerk them out of the U.S. Senate and put in a man that they considered to be better. And so the 17th said, "Oh, we've got to elect the two U.S. senators from each state. We've got to elect them at large, just like we do our congressmen." But what happened was the states lost their suffrage. The only thing they've got left that might be classified as suffrage would be the Electoral College, and that's not very effective. So I'd like to get back just a little bit to what I said again about the offer that Lucifer made to Christ, the wealth, power, and kingdoms. Every kingdom ends up being the government in these kingdoms becomes evil. It becomes just contrary to the best interests of the country. Now we hear about Libya, Tunisia. We have the Egypt and Syria. These fellows that get in the driver's seat in these countries amass great fortunes. The greed factor is there, and the lust for power over people. This is what leads them down the primrose trail to destruction. And so Satan's kingdoms do not survive. But it doesn't take long, and he'll, if there's a new government, why, he'll start the process again and go through the same thing again. The founders of this country were wise men, and they tried to keep us from getting into that position. Now, they gave us, this is going to be a shock to you, they gave us a three-vote system. The first vote is when you go to the polls on election day and you elect your congressman and your senator and that. Your next vote is on the grand jury. And your third vote is on the trial jury. One person on a trial jury can deny the government a conviction. Why? Because that one juror has more authority than the President of the United States. He is sovereign. That one person is sovereign. We've lost our sovereignty in this country because we didn't protect our sovereignty. We didn't protect our sovereignty with our vote on grand juries and we didn't protect our sovereignty on the trial jury. We didn't protect it, and we lost it. And that's one of the biggest failures that any great nation has ever. I mean, this is catastrophic. And I dare say you probably have never heard what I just said. We have a three-vote political system. The second and third votes, those are after you elect these people. And if they don't perform the way you want them to, if they are lying, if they're not doing their job, you watch them and see if they're committing a crime. And if they're committing a crime, you indict them. And then they have to go to trial before a jury. And so we were taught about the checks and balances in our government school education, but they only told us about the checks and balances between the executive, judicial, and legislative branches of government. They did not want you to know that the grand jury and the petit jury, the trial jury, are the two most important parts of our system of checks and balances, the separation of powers. They didn't want you to know.
Well, that's very profound. You may know that I do a lot of work on the grand jury issue at the Post and Email, because what citizens have brought forth to me is that there's a tremendous amount of not only corruption, sin, what have you, but these grand juries have basically sold themselves out to a prosecutor, a district attorney, which I guess is a prosecutor, and they are not serving the rights of the people at all. They are an
Absolutely.
Arm of the government.
And what it does, the people in the U.S. Justice Department are committing more felonies. They belong in jail if they don't explain to that grand jury how that they are the ones with the power.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. attorney is just a servant. But those people on that grand jury are the masters. But how can you be a master if you weren't ever taught how to be a master? I wrote it up in my first book in 1980, Born Again Republic. I wrote it up about the three votes of the people way back then. I've been on hundreds of talk shows and talked about this. I've done hundreds of seminars and presentations of all kinds. And you know, I'm disappointed, of course, because Not too many people, not enough people have been listening. However, I've done my part. I'm not in the class with Isaiah, don't get me wrong. But he had a responsibility, and I had a responsibility, and everybody that is listening tonight, they also have a responsibility, and they need to get their selves informed and get themselves out there. I have copies of The Law That Never Was, Volume 1. That's the one that you have to have if you're going to introduce it in court. I have copies. They're for sale. And all I can say is that get yourself informed. And you're not going to be effective until you get yourself deprogrammed of all the lies and the falsehoods that have been dished out to us on a daily basis.
Wow, that's extremely profound. It kind of informs all of us listening, and hopefully those of us whom we will inform in the coming days, that the reality that we thought we had is not really here. The reality that the founders wanted us to have, we've never experienced, not anyone alive today.
I think our time has about run out, but
we've got about 3 minutes, Red. Sharon, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay.
The wealth, the power, and the kingdoms of the earth. One of the kingdoms that is really a problem, and that is organized religion. Organized religion is a grant that Lucifer has given to people. The hierarchy of organized religion are some of the most arrogant people and such that I've ever met in my life. And they're living like kings. The king I serve didn't have a place to lay his head. We've got guys out there running religious religious corporations, and they own airplanes, jet planes. They've got ranches. They've got all kinds of things. They've got their kingdom, and it's here on Earth, and they're going to get a very, very bad surprise. I mean, the surprise for them is going to be rather serious.
Mm-hmm. And we know that the founders were godly men. We know that they were not materialistic. They were willing to lose everything to fight the revolution so that we could be free.
It's going to take a lot of commitment.
Well, thank you so much for your very in-depth explanation about the 16th Amendment and how you came to study it and to find out what the truth was and is, and also for edifying all of us as to what we can do going forward and what we might expect for the United States of America in the coming months.
Well, Sharon, I want to thank you for being such a wonderful host tonight. This has been a great interview, and you are certainly a world-class interviewer. We knew that about you before we ever had you on Walls in Our Minds, but you've proven it out, and we want to invite you back. This is a forum which is available to you at any time, and we want to stay in touch with you and have you back often. And you've been a wonderful guest in the past and a great host tonight. And Dr. Kate is saying, me too, Terry, and she just is encouraging me to let you know how much we appreciate you here at Walls in Our Minds and on Dr. Kate's Revolution Radio.
Well, thank you so very much for having me. It was just a pleasure, and thank you again, Mr. Beckman.
it's nice to have had this 2 hours to discuss all of this, and I hope that it didn't all fall on deaf ears, and I hope that it motivates somebody someplace to become a part of this.
What is the army of the Lord? Picked up and dusted off.
Thank you, Red. Good night, Sharon. Good night, Red. Good night, Kate. Good night, everybody. Good
night, everybody.
And not let Satan have one more. What is the church, for heaven's sake? Finally stepped up to the